For an even better way to listen to Football Weekly at home, at work or on the go, head to soundcloud.com/Guardian Football Weekly or download the SoundCloud app for Android and iPhone.
Confederations Cup Football Daily with James Richardson.
Brightening up your Monday, it's Confederations Cup Football Daily with today another big BT for Tahiti. Not always you can say 8-0 about a game featuring Luis Suarez, but that was the scoreline for Uruguay in Recife. Now for the Celeste, it's a semi-final with Brazil, while Spain, who beat Nigeria, have another go at the Italians. It's like 2012 and 1950 all over again. All of that discussed, plus on-air firings, excitingly enough, in today's Confederations Cup Football Daily. Yeah, hi everybody. A new week begins. A new week begins. Same old face of Jacob Steinberg, though, here in the pod.
Hello, James.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
All right, you're fresh from Spain, Nigeria.
Yeah, it was a good game.
Yeah, we didn't see it, did we, Ian McIntosh?
Oh, right.
No, we were watching the Tahiti.
We were, engrossed, as we were, by Tahiti's epic struggle against not being very good at football.
Yeah. How'd that go for them?
Not well. I'll level with you. But it was interesting because when they played Spain, everybody attacked them for their tactical naivety, their high line, forcing themselves upon the game. They said, naive. So it was nice that today they defended very, very deep. And largely the same result, strangely enough.
Right. Well, it was a second string, was it? Second string Uruguay 11 that they were facing?
Yeah, sadly, they didn't let Suarez on until the 68th minute, I think. So before that, it was practically a completely new team. Mm. And they did have a few problems at first. It took them until the 24th minute to get a second goal on after opening the goal scoring early, because Tahiti just sat deep with a flat back five and four men in front. They didn't particularly press. They didn't challenge for much. They just sort of got in the way, and it was a very useful strategy for a time.
Plus, their third-string keeper looked quite tasty.
Oh, he looked a lot better than their second-string keeper, who played against Spain, didn't he? Yeah, that was Gilbert Merrill.
Mm-hmm. Of course it was.
Saved a penalty, an outstanding claim from across, a number of good saves. He did very well for himself.
Mm. Who else are you going to treasure from this little Tahitian interlude?
Well, I particularly like Stevie Chong Hugh, who I'm sure you've already heard of. I can see with your face you're very familiar with his work. He was just flying down the flank at them. He pretty much created...
They did fly down a bit. You were saying about sitting back, but they were on the break quite a bit.
Yeah, on the counter they did exactly as they did with Spain, just starting from about 20 or 30 metres further backwards. But they did again, they went for it. Villas-Boas would have liked them. They're full of vertical passes.
Abel Hernandez.
Yes, he had a very good day. After a couple of misses, he racked up four on his own. And yet it was Suarez, of course, who's now Uruguay's top goal scorer of all time in his own personal duel with Diego Forlan.
That one's not over, though, is it?
No, I suspect this one will be running. But, it was a shame he wasn't playing for the whole game, because there was no compassion there. There was no sympathy for Tahiti. He was on to do a job and score goals, and he was superb at
it. If you had a bag of kittens to drown, he'd be the man you'd pick.
Definitely.
To do it. Now, meantime, while all of this was going on, Jacob, how was Spain getting on against Nigeria?
They were getting on pretty well. They took the lead after 3 minutes. Jordi Alba scored. I think that there's slight trade descriptions that they've messed it up a little bit there, Spain, because Jordi Alba isn't a left-back. He's the least defensive left-back I think I've ever seen.
Even more than the Brazilian ones?
Yeah, but compared to the Brazilian ones, he's actually superb in front of goal as well. He's someone who's going to score quite a few goals. And as we saw in the Euro 2012 final, streaking forward and running onto those passes, he's more or less a winger. But to be fair to him, he can get back and defend, as he had to do a couple of times tonight. But he gives them that extra dimension, I think, the width and the pace that on that left side, Jordi Alba. And he scored after 3 minutes, managed to get through a couple of challenges on which kind of weak challenges from the Nigeria defence, and then he was bizarrely, David Villa was from deep position in the Spain half, was playing him in the 88th minute, and Jordi Alba was the furthest Spain player forward by quite some distance. Mm. Went through and just rounded the goalkeeper and stroked it into the empty net like a striker.
Right.
I think he was a left winger or possibly a striker when he was coming through at whatever club it was he started his career at. So, you know, you can kind of see why he has that composure in front of goal.
Yeah.
Great play.
Fantastic performance. Fernando Torres scoring again.
It was a good goal. Diving header. Mm. Cross from Pedro, which is a little bit sort of un-Spanish, you know. cross from the left and a header. But Torres came on, and it only took him a couple of minutes to score tonight. And actually, Soldado didn't do himself too many favours with a couple of very tame finishes when he was through in the first half twice. And Torres came on for him and immediately made an impact. So yeah, Spain more or less just looking very good. Although they actually had quite a few problems at the back. Nigeria had quite a few chances, especially in the first half, and there was a little suggestion here or there, especially when it was 1-0, that they might be able to equalise, but they just weren't clinical enough.
Nigeria, their tournament ends a little bit disappointingly, no?
Well, I think they probably always knew they were going to lose to Spain, so I think it basically got away from them when they lost to Uruguay on Thursday night. So, you know, you would expect Uruguay to beat Tahiti as they did 8-0, and you'd expect Nigeria to lose to Spain as they did 3-0. And so it was kind of a foregone conclusion tonight. But I think they can be quite pleased with actually how they acquitted themselves. You know, a lot of teams against Spain will just sit back and accept the death by passing that's going to occur, and they actually really took the game to them at times, and there were times where they made the Spain defence look not very competent at all. Because some good young players. It's a developing team, I think, this Nigeria side. The most surprising thing for me, for a lot of English people who probably watched that game, was how John Obi Mikel played in an advanced role. Apparently he can do things like running and shooting.
Well, yeah, this was being mentioned the other day.
I'm not at all comfortable with that. I prefer it when he just sort of shuffles around behind the midfield and just generally shuffles into place, stops things happening, shuffles off again. I'm not happy with this attacking midfielder, Mikel.
I know, he can run, he can shoot, and there was one moment in the first half where he showed a great piece of vision to stab a kind of Paul Scholes-type pass over the top of the Spain defence. It was superb, and obviously Nigeria, as they were doing throughout the evening, messed up the chance, but it was brilliant.
Well, maybe this move to a Galatasaray that's being talked about is exactly what he needs. He can take over the Schneider role there.
Well, yeah, and when he was bought by Chelsea, I think that was what he was meant to be, but it's never ever turned out like that.
I remember being at Chelsea with the press box is right behind the bench, and when Scolari first started there, Mikel would occasionally wander up and have a shot, but he was so awful at shooting that Scolari would scream and scream and scream until he turned purple, ordering Mikel back. And you don't have to be screamed at by Scolari very many times to take notice, and that was the last time I saw him cross the halfway line, I think.
Right, well, poor chap. Poor chap. Well, and now it's going to be Uruguay taking on Brazil on Wednesday night, and Thursday, Spain, Italy. Uruguay, Brazil. Has that game happened before?
I believe it has somewhere.
Tell us more, Ian.
1950. Yeah. Not the World Cup final, as some believe, but one of the last games in the group stage that they had to decide the World Cup. And, of course, Uruguay broke Brazilian
hearts. Sure, it wasn't the final.
It was a group stage that finished the tournament.
It was deciding.
Oh, because they didn't actually have a final. Oh, so it was the deciding game.
Yeah, but it wasn't a standalone.
It wasn't a standalone final. Right,
but it was the game that made Pelé's dad cry.
Right.
And Pelé, very young at the time, I think 10 or 11, leaned over to his dad and said, "Don't worry, I'll go and win the World Cup for you."
What a great story,
isn't that?
Because usually you just hear about all the people throwing themselves off the tops of buildings.
Yeah, they're not great stories.
No.
See, that's why I'm convinced that Brazil are going to do something horrific next year as well. It's going to be some serious trauma going on.
Why?
One thing that is not going to happen next year is Brazil, no matter how good they might be in a year's time, they will not win that World Cup. And the way that they go out
is going to be... Well, how can you be so sure about this?
Because it's Brazil in Brazil, it's just something farcical is going to happen.
Okay, for a start, every World Cup is really set up to benefit the home nation.
But not 1950.
Okay, not these days. There seem to have been concerted policy of easing host nations as far as possible into the tournament. So I think that...
all I'm saying is they will be going out probably semi-finals or quarter-finals, something like penalties or a ludicrous goal that should have been disallowed or something. And I'm just pinpointing it's just Suarez is going to have something to do with it. They'll be losing to Uruguay again, and offside goal.
Are you detecting a hint of the old-fashioned Manchester Cities about Brazil?
Yeah, just but
disaster
just
can never be far away.
In 2016 or 2018, whenever it is, they can go and win it. But it doesn't matter. They might as well not turn up next year.
I think that they're greatly improved from where they were just 3 or 4 months ago.
Well, it's interesting you said there was a massive debate, massive among the 65 comments that were there. But in the comment section of yesterday's Confederations Cup Football Daily, There's some people saying Brazil no good, other people saying Brazil clearly building.
I don't think they're there yet. No. I don't think when they get caught on the break, their fullbacks are so high and the cover from the two defensive midfielders isn't always what it could be. But compared to where they were 3 months ago when they were on that dreadful run of hardly winning a game, I think they've really made a big step up, and the team spirit there, every time they score you see the subs piling off the bench to join in, so there's definitely something happening there. But I do kind of agree with Jacob.
Here's an example. Slim Pickin saying all this praise for Neymar, because it was another hot topic. All this praise for Neymar, who's been okay but hardly a revelation, is covering up the fact that Brazil are a pretty horrible team. There's odd moments of inspiration, but they spend most of the game systematically fouling opponents, feigning injury and complaining to the referee. It's not pretty, and it's not what I'd expect from what used to be the most entertaining team in the world. The Italians think that the Brazil side is pretty special, but then I guess you do think that when you've been beaten 4-2 by somebody.
Yeah, I don't think they're very special. But then I guess if you do have someone like Neymar, who, again, didn't do a lot last night in that game, but at the same time is capable of coming up with that one moment of inspiration, the free kick, and as he's done in each of the three games so far, if you do have that play, you have that slight chance, no matter how fragmented the team might seem at times.
Mm. So what do you think then when they face Suarez this time around on Wednesday, Brazil-Uruguay?
I think it will be a harder game possibly than people for Brazil than maybe people will expect. I think Uruguay will make it difficult for them, and obviously in the likes of Suarez and Cavani, they have the players who can take advantage of what I don't see as a very good defence,
right.
Brazilian defence.
I'm not sure.
I wouldn't be surprised if Uruguay win. They've been known to do this before. You know, Copa America in 2011, they had the quarter final against Argentina, and I think they hung on grimly off the top of my head with 10 men for quite a long time, and ended up winning on penalties in Argentina.
There you go.
I do think Brazil are vulnerable, but at the same time, I haven't seen anything from Uruguay to suggest that they can get to the final here. They weren't very good at all against Spain. They were quite fortunate to beat Nigeria, and obviously I don't think we can take much into their 8-0 drubbing of Tahiti. Mm. But I do agree with Jacob. Brazil are definitely vulnerable.
Well, the following night is what looks like a very evenly balanced match between Spain and Italy.
Do you think so?
No.
No. All right.
No. Well, Spanish, of course, what was it, 4-0?
Yeah, but that was slightly skewed, wasn't it, by the fact that Italy sort of ended that game with about 8 men.
Mm. Well, they're dropping like flies this time around, I have to say. Already they'd lost Pirlo and De Rossi for the game against Brazil. Now, Balotelli's been limping around after tweeting about how we've been waiting a year to get Spain back. He's now in doubt himself. Abate's out as well with a dislocated shoulder. So Laura was spot on with his diagnosis. And, well, that's all sorts of problems, isn't it, really? Because the defence is the massive problem. All the Italian press today picking up on the fact that they can't defend anymore. 8 goals conceded in the 3 games.
Some of them have been really bad as well, haven't they? The goals that they've let in.
And Buffon's not saving us this time around, as one paper put it. Now, again, people... in quite a heated debate on the Buffon question, which was raised in commentary yesterday. We were saying we thought it was a bit harsh, saying that he was over or finished, but real revolt, swearing, going all sweary about it. He's gone, he's finished, he says, and throwing in some caps lock and a bit of an exclamation mark. He was responsible for... He certainly does. According to Real Revolt, Buffon responsible for all 4 Brazilian goals. I can't believe there's not a better goalkeeper in Italy than a clearly past it Buffon. I think he's looking a bit rusty.
He didn't have a very good game,
no.
Certainly, but it might be a little forward to say that he's completely gone. Players do just have bad games. I think it was Gary Nelson in Left Foot Forward who said that it's younger players can have bad games. For older players, it always means they're on the turn.
Right.
So I think the jury's still out on that one, but certainly, yeah, I can see the argument that he was responsible for all 4 the other night.
Mm. Shut Up Legs says, I'd add that I want to see more of Marchetti, as he's outperformed Buffon domestically this season too. Marchetti's interesting because he was the fellow who spent an entire season out of Cagliari's lineup because he casually mentioned that he wouldn't mind a transfer away, and the club reacted very angrily and basically sent him to Coventry, although not literally.
Italian for Coventry?
I don't know, Jacob. One of the many things I don't know. I don't know if there is such a thing.
Oh.
Hmm. There might be. If you know, listeners, do let us know. Funnily enough, I was speaking to a real Italian today, actually. Can you guess who it was?
No.
Gianluca Vialli.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was buying popcorn at the cinema, and the fella, I tried to pay, and the cashier said, I can't, because the other fella's left his popcorn in and got off to collect some drinks. I turned around to see who the inconsiderate fellow was, and it was only Gianluca Vialli. So we had it out there and there.
What was said?
Well, he said, ciao! And I said, ciao, and we had a bit of a chat, actually. It was nice.
How is he?
He seemed really well. He'd gone to see Despicable Me 2 with his two kids. Lovely daughters, oh. Yeah. And I went with the Jimbo clan Jimbo, Team Jimbo. So we introduced each other, and that was that. Yeah.
Is Despicable Me 2 worth going to see?
I'm going
to
say no. I'm going to say no, and I know that might disappoint people, but it was a bit lazy. The first one was clearly put together with a bit of an idea behind it, and this time around they just went, everyone loved those characters, we'll just get those characters to kind of do more or less the same thing, the little fellas to fall over and laugh at each other, and we'll throw in a bit of a story about a romance, and then, oh yeah, at the end. There obviously was a concept behind the sequel when it was first pitched, but because all the other ideas that people came onto the brainstorming sessions with, oh, what would be great if Gru did this, or it goes on a date, etc., all the actual story got pushed to the final third, and they wrapped it up really, really quickly, and then everybody goes home. But it's not without its treats. It's better than Man of Steel.
Well, yeah, I saw it. Jacob.
God, that is one of the worst films I've ever seen. Mm. It's just all illogical. The storyline made no sense.
I just thought it was really boring. It was Krypton hits other man from Krypton who hits him back again.
It's like Bring on the Wall, wasn't it? Just, you know, just throw Zod into a wall, throw Superman into a wall.
Yeah. And then we didn't like it.
Over and over again.
Film producers,
yeah.
Try harder.
Zod was so angry as well. Imagine having to... Why would you pick him as your leader when he's got those anger issues?
Well, maybe... I think maybe he was more angry after being sent to that weird limbo place.
He was angry from the start, though.
Well, he was angry because the politicians, and I don't know if there's some kind of parallel here, the politicians, through their willful inaction, had allowed the planet to come to the brink and indeed arrive at ecological disaster. I think he was very angry about that, as no doubt we will be when the politicians do the same to us.
I'd be more angry about being trapped in a floating mirror and sent through space for half of the time.
Yeah, they didn't even have to...
But then reprise for the cover of Queen's Greatest Hits.
Yeah. I'm not even going to bother with this.
Anyway, Jacob, have you ever bumped into a former footballer in an incongruous surrounding?
I've not bumped into I've bumped into a current footballer.
Oh, go on then.
It was the day after the 2002 FA Cup final between Arsenal and Chelsea, and I was out for dinner with my family in London, and the game had obviously been in Cardiff because that's when they were playing it there, and Sol Campbell was having lunch on his own, completely.
Really?
The day after, having played in the FA Cup final.
Wow.
Yeah.
And, tells a story, doesn't it?
Sort of, I was about 13 or 14 or whatever, and went over and, I was ordered to go over and say hi and say well done.
And how did he respond to this?
He didn't really react that well.
Did he not?
No, he didn't want to be bothered at all. Oh. I thought it was a bit strange to be like that the day after you've completed the double.
Jay Bothroyd in La Porchetta Pizzeria in Muswell Hill. Oh,
it's a good place. Have you ever done the whole pretend it's someone's birthday in there and they come out and throw
they
pizza
throw
dough
a
on you?
Yeah. Pizza dough on your head. Yeah. Anyway, who have you got, Ian?
I was in a pub in London watching the cricket once, the 2020 World Cup, and was talking to a little old fellow with big thick glasses about the rules of the power over, their penalty shootout equivalent, and it wasn't until I left I realised it was Charlie George.
Wow.
I know. I didn't have a chance to ask him anything.
Wow. How did the realisation dawn on you?
You know when you're talking to someone and you think, I'm sure I've met you somewhere before, and then you sit down and go, oh yes, he's the one who scored that goal and laid down, among many other things. Mm.
That was him.
Brian Robson on holiday once in Tenerife.
Did you? Yeah. Where?
Tenerife. It was the season Middlesbrough went down in 97, when they got to the two cup finals and they went down. I think it was probably an international break during that time, and he was off on holiday and he was on a big table with his family.
I see you, Brian Robson. I raise you Tony DiRigo at Lisbon Airport.
I see you, Tony DiRigo, at Lisbon Airport. And I raise you a female friend of mine who was in a bar in Portugal and was hit on by Teddy Sheringham and then Teddy Sheringham's son, Charlie. That's, it was like a
I'm
like
a bad
team.
Taste in my mouth.
The thing is, if you want to get away from Sheringham, it's going to be hard as he couldn't run. So,
but the first yard's in his head.
It's true, yeah.
Listeners, where's the weirdest place you've ever bumped into a footballer? Do let us know. And Gus Poyet, we've got to mention that. What happened there? Were you watching?
I wasn't. I was watching Uruguay Tahiti.
But yeah, but Jacob, that's where it happened.
It didn't happen at Uruguay Tahiti, but in the studio on the other channel.
Oh, it was on the other channel. Mm. Oh, right.
Yeah, no, he had to sit there and take it as a man by the name of Mark Chapman read out Brighton's statement that had been sent, I think, the BBC had printed it off during the first half. It was about 15 minutes into the Spain-Uruguay game where suddenly, I think people in the office started saying, oh, Gus Poyet's been sacked. And so, well, he's in the studio on the BBC sofa.
But now I'm a bit squirming mystified on the BBC because sofa. I thought he and Brighton had effectively parted ways back at the start of the summer.
Well, he got suspended, didn't he? Yeah. But they never actually sacked him. And there's been this war of words, I think, that's been going on.
But he can't be surprised about it.
I think he's probably surprised at the timing. And I'm sure someone at Brighton knew that he was on national television doing some punditry.
Maybe,
and he had to sit there and take it.
Maybe seeing him on national television is what reminded them to get on with it.
It's June, isn't it? So, yeah.
Yeah.
You know. Holidays and
do we know what he was actually suspended for? I mean, can
is this
connected
email,
to pooing?
I believe it was the angry email he sent about
the poo,
the pooing, and the question that you now ask is with him being sacked, is what happens to his number two? Does he leave his number two behind at the club? Or but that's not something we know at this stage. Anyway, but yeah, on-air sackings and genius tweet from Bearded Genius who says, pundit sacked live on the BBC. No, it's not one of the six you were hoping.
Nice.
Conservative figures as well. Now, do you know, I think we've actually come to the end of today's particular pod rainbow. So that's a big thank you to Jacob Steinberg.
Thank you.
You're off to Wimbledon tomorrow, Jacob.
I am. SW19, here I come.
All right.
Yeah.
Stop your grinning and drop your linen. Southwest London. Ian McIntosh, where are you off to tomorrow?
I'm not off anywhere.
Okay.
I'm afraid. Very, very boring day.
All right. Super. It is a Monday. And, well, listeners, you enjoy whatever you're up to as this new week gets itself into gear. We'll be back on Wednesday with our reaction to that Brazil-Uruguay clash. So do join us for that on Thursday morning, if that's more at your convenience. So producer Ben, thanks for putting it all together again. Have a super start to your week. Bye for now.
CCFD with AC Jimbo. Worth.